You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 8th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Wan Shang Hao. Good evening to all of our listeners in China.
I liked your intonation.
Of which there are probably
inflection.
Not
sure if it was accurate, though, but it sounded good.
Does anyone listen to us in China?
Of course. Yeah, we have some Chinese listeners.
But if you use the wrong inflection, you say, I want to massage your grandmother, so you got to be careful.
Yeah, you do have to. You know, the thing about saying good evening in Chinese is that I want to say it again in an hour. I don't know what it is.
OMG.
Wow.
That was so
bad. He's been working on that joke all night.
Where's my rim shot? Oh, crud.
You get a sad trombone.
Rebecca, you are joining us from London this week.
I am.
I say.
Yes, I'm back in old Blighty, as no one calls it.
Rebecca Poppins.
So yeah, you're once again, the listeners are once again being treated to Rebecca at 1:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
But you're still kind of on U.S. time.
No. No, not really.
Actually, no.
But you're not in a bad mood.
No. Not really.
Well, at least you're happy recording the show.
Evan, tell us what is absolutely fascinating about this day in skepticism.
Well, on this day that you're listening to the show, it was 1854, in which the famous mathematician Bernhard Riemann posed that space is curved. And he announced this at a lecture titled On the Hypothesis of Which Geometry is Based, which is apparently a very famous lecture that he gave. And what he did is he described the old-fashioned Euclidean two-dimensional plane geometry, along with some other examples of old geometry. And, well, let me put it to you this way. There's an example on which a piece of paper, there lived a bookworm, right? And this bookworm was drawn on the piece of paper, so it was two-dimensional. So you take the paper, and you fold it up, and you crumple it up. Now, the worm drawn on the paper has no sense of the crumbling and the distortion of space that's going on around him because he also exists in two dimensions. Right? You follow me so far?
Yeah, gotcha.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas actually that crumpled paper is in three dimensions. So extend that out. We live in a world of three dimensions that actually everything going around us exists in what he believed is four dimensions, the fourth dimension being time. And this was important, not only as an important discovery of his time, but it also influenced scientists and physicists such as Einstein, who used Riemann's work in his theory of general relativity, in which he incorporated time as the fourth dimension.
Yeah, but when Riemann was talking about higher dimensions, I think he was talking about higher spatial dimensions, not necessarily time as the fourth dimension. That was something that Einstein inserted. He was saying that space itself is curved into a physical fourth dimension, which we can't perceive because we're on the surface of the paper like the
That's
angel
right.
worm.
We're yeah. like the worm. The worm on the two-dimensional yeah. worm on the paper has no idea it's getting all crumpled and crushed up.
But it's interesting. Imagine being the first guy to think that space is not linear, that it's not Euclidean, that it's curved. That's mind-blowing.
That's a
right?
big deal.
The way he did that, the way he did that was to, I guess he was the first one to think of actually introducing a collection of numbers at every point in space. And that was how we came upon the idea of using that method to describe how it was bent. A pretty key insight. I wonder how relativity would have been affected if he hadn't come up with that. I wonder if it would have been delayed significantly.
I don't know. For some reason, it reminds me a lot of, was it Plato? Plato's cave wall idea of people who are, just
shadows.
Yeah, just seeing shadows on a cave wall. And so they assume that that's all that life is, are these two dimensional shadows. And so if you were to explain the three dimensional world to them, it would blow their minds. And of course, I mean, you can't say that Plato was thinking in terms of, well, maybe there's a fourth dimension, a fourth spatial dimension as such. But I mean, I think that he was thinking in those sorts of terms, don't you think?
Yeah, well, that our perception of reality is shaped by the physical reality in which we live. And it,
right.
we yeah. may be ignorant of reality in the same way that the cave shadow people are ignorant of their ultimate reality.
Right. And that's not to suggest that Plato had any sort of evidence of a fourth spatial dimension. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, he wasn't saying
there's
that.
There's a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, he was talking more in just general philosophical terms, not that specific right. manifestation, yeah. right?
Bob, what about this thing where, okay, we have three dimensions that we can easily perceive and understand, but why do the dimensions end there? Like, in other words, why couldn't there have been a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, a seventh, an eighth dimension that are physical dimensions?
There actually might be, and some theories actually, some string theories and things actually consider that and have that as an integral part of it, but those dimensions are kind of, it's kind of weird, but they're actually wrapped up and compacted into such a small space that they're not visible easily. So, so higher dimensions can exist in our universe, but we just can't really detect it yet, and it's not obvious like the three spatial dimensions that we're aware of now.
I've heard that membrane theory or M theory relies on 11 dimensions. They can calculate 11 dimensions based on those theories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've heard of other theories talking about other dimensions of time. Imagine two dimensions of time, you know, say four or five dimensions of space and then two of time. What would that be like?
Crazy. That would be
crazy. Like, how many two watches wherever you go?
That kind of stuff only makes sense in the context of mathematics, though. We can't, you know, really think about it physically.
Well, just because we can think of them mathematically, does that mean that they actually exist?
No.
No.
But there is something to the fact that it makes the math more elegant. It sort of solves problems to bump things up a dimension and think of our reality as a three-dimensional manifestation of a four-dimensional reality or whatever, however how many you ultimately get up to. So, you know, what does that mean? This is a big question in theoretical, you know, physics or science in general. When things start to fit together and become more elegant and have explanatory power, that's nice, but it's not the same thing as direct evidence that it's actually the case. And that's where we get into the debate about whether or not, you know, string theory and M theory are real science, because they're not empirical yet, they're just theoretical. Well, we have a couple of news items coming up. Phil Plait's going to be joining us in a little while to talk about some astronomy news, but first we have a couple of other news items. The first one is SGU related. Do you guys know? I know you guys know, but what's going to happen? I hope you know by now. September 23rd and 24th, this fall, 2011, a very special event will be occurring. We have decided for some crazy reason to do a 24-hour live video and audio streaming SGU event.
Extravaganza.
Crazy is right.
and I want everyone to know from the beginning, like, I'm totally against it.
Yeah. Yes, we are bringing Jay kicking and screaming to this event,
which should only make it more entertaining, I think.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I just thought of a name. I just thought of a name for it.
What?
Skeptapalooza.
Oh, come on.
That's a terrible
Skeptapalooza. Bob.
That's terrible.
Best one I've heard yet.
Our working title is just SGU 24. But we're certainly open to suggestions.
Now, I get to play Jack Bauer then.
Yeah.
Where's the bomb?
Does that mean we get to torch you and stop your heart and then get it going again?
Yeah, jump my heart with a car battery and then I'll get up and do another 14 hours of show. I loved every goddamn season of that program.
You know, Jay,
seasons.
For some reason, when I hear 24-hour show, it doesn't really bother me that much. But then when you mentioned 14 hours, it occurred to me, like, we'll have already been recording for 10 hours, and then we'll still have 14 hours to go. And now I'm against it, too.
Well, that's like when we were flying to Australia, and you're on the plane for what seems like forever, and you find out that you still have 10 more hours left on the plane. Yeah, that's rough. Won't be quite that bad because, you know, we'll be in my house, not on a plane.
We like doing the heavy lifting, these special events, these things that, you know, other sane people would never try. Right?
So more details will be unfolding over the ensuing months, but save the date, September 23rd at 8 p.m., and for the following 24 hours, you will be able to eat, sleep, and breathe the SGU. And it'll be video, And we will be broadcasting from a very special location.
You already said from your house.
But it's a special, it's a special location within my house.
Right.
It's the bathroom.
And we haven't named it yet. We're going to give it a special name.
But no, we did name it.
It's the Skeptolair.
I thought it was
the Skeptoman Cave with Rebecca.
It's just going to continue to get worse, isn't it?
Unfortunately. Well,
this show will be fused. It'll be infused with Star Trek, with Star Wars, with internet. It'll have TVs. It'll have computers. It'll have gadgets. It'll have things that pop and bubble.
A couple skulls.
And there'll be smoke.
And no bathroom breaks. We'll be jumping up and down on one leg. By the
we'll have catheters going to bottles strapped to our thighs.
And like one dead body.
Ooh.
There will be at least one dead body, yes.
At least.
At least.
If not more.
You know, the SGU just jumped the shock.
Also, we'll be introducing a young child on the show. We're going to have a new 6-year-old love child.
I thought you were referencing Oliver from the Brady Bunch.
Oliver, there was...
Remember that punk?
The kid on Married with Children.
You remember the Brady Bunch, Rebecca? No?
I've heard of the Brady Bunch.
It was before She's my time. Heard of the Brady
anyway,
Bunch.
The point is...
Pork chops and applesauce.
Oh, my nose.
Are these Brady Bunch jokes? Is that
Mom
what
always
we
said,
we
don't pay ball in the house.
Yeah, it's that's why they're all zooming over your head.
Yes.
Yes.
Can we go back to Star Trek, please?
Whoa.
He's dead, Jim.
Never thought I'd hear her say that.
But worse, can you imagine 24 hours of this?
I'm just going to bring earplugs. I'm going to bring a big pair of headphones. Just listen to my music.
Noise cancellation phones. All right, let's go on.
Cancellation phones.
To another news item. Rebecca, a psychic, gave a very interesting tip to the police.
That's right, Steve.
And how did that turn out?
Texas authorities find up to 30 bodies. That was the headline that Reuters decided to run with. Texas authorities find up to 30 bodies, including children buried in a mass grave in a rural home east of Houston, local media reported. it goes on to say it might not have been 30, it was 25 to 30, but preliminary reports did indicate that they were children. So a really horrific scene there Tuesday night. That was on June 7th. And a lot of confusion as reports were coming in, but turns out, okay, that this amazing find was in fact discovered by a psychic. It came in through a psychic tip. The psychic told the police to go to this specific house in Texas and to search for bodies. The police went there. They didn't find anything. So the same caller, the same anonymous psychic caller, called back and again stated that there were bodies there. The police were just in the slightly wrong spot. So the psychic gave even more exact directions. So the police went back and they found nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. There was nothing. They found a small amount of blood on the porch of a house nearby. And for some reason that turned into Texas authorities find up to 30 bodies, including children, which is basically what the psychic had reported. But try as they might, the Texas authorities were actually unable to find any evidence of any bodies. The homeowners, the people who lived in the house on that property were truckers. They were cross-country truckers. They were out on the road when this happened. When reached for comment, they said no, they were not murderers.
We don't know nothing about no bodies.
Exactly.
No bodies.
Apparently some slightly deranged person had cut his wrists on their porch a few weeks back.
Apparently it was the daughter's fiance who was AWOL from the Army.
Yes.
And cut himself deliberately and bled all over the place. And mm-hmm. now is in a military psych facility, apparently.
Yes. And so, there was absolutely nothing. There was no sign of any bodies anywhere on the property. There was no reason to suspect that these people killed anyone. It was all thanks to one anonymous, quote unquote, psychic. So now, after it's finally come out that there were, in fact, no bodies, the police are discussing trying to charge the tipster, although there's no real indication of whether or not they'll be able to discover the identity of the caller. But hopefully they can, and hopefully this person will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, because this is what we see again and again. We see, you know, when you ask what's the harm of psychic detectives, you know, they're just adding another, you know, possibility of finding a body or finding a murderer. Well, this is the problem. You have somebody who thinks that they're a psychic offering their, what they think they, you know, and they might actually believe this. They may actually think that they are having psychic visions about something and think that they're helping. But what they're only doing really is wasting the police's time. Can you imagine like how many detectives and how many officers had to be on the scene searching this property to find absolutely nothing?
And the FBI got involved.
Yeah. Surely they had something better to do.
Yeah.
There were aerial video pictures of the groups, all the cars and all the detectives and the personnel. It was throngs of people. Right. At this supposed place. It was a huge waste of resources. Huge.
Yeah. And, of course, to me, it's still not as bad as the cases you have where there's been, say, a disappearance of someone and a quote-unquote psychic contacts the relatives or someone and says that they have evidence of where this person is.
The kid's dead.
Exactly.
Thank you, Sylvia.
The kid's dead.
Exactly. I mean, that causes an incredible amount of emotional, psychological damage to these families. In this case, at least the damage was just economic, I suppose. But that's your tax dollars at work, tracking down the pointless tips from psychics.
Now, Rebecca, there was a few details to this story that I found very interesting. But, of course, I'm basing this. I read multiple articles on this, and there was shuffling around the same basic facts. But one was the blood on the porch. Another mm-hmm. one, though, was that when the cops got there, they described a quote-unquote overwhelming smell of decomposition.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that noted as well.
Yeah, so now you have the blood and the decomp, so they're thinking, all right, this is legit. There's something here.
Right.
And that's how they justified the massive response. Mm-hmm. You know, initially just a couple of guys going to check it out, but then these details led to calling in the FBI and the bigger response. Plus, they also noted that there were some details, some geographic details of the layout of the house that the psychic got pretty accurately, and that convinced him also that this was a legitimate tip and not just
right.
a lunatic.
And of course, maybe the psychic just had knowledge of this area, had been by or something.
Yeah.
There was also the fact that apparently the property owner's son is a convicted sex offender, though he hasn't lived there for over a year. And the smell, the foul stench that the police apparently identified was found to be coming from piles of rotting garbage.
Yeah. They're truckers who were on the road, so.
Right.
Yeah.
There were a lot of little details that, when combined with this quote unquote psychic tip, led the police to realizing they needed, they needed to do something because these were all adding up, kind of a confirmation bias.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. It's circumstantial evidence, confirmation bias, and you think, oh, what's the chance, that the police checking out a tip are going to find blood on the porch? Well, it turns out it's probably not. First of all, that's the wrong question. The question is not what's the chance of finding blood. What's the chance of finding something suspicious?
Right.
And all the different things that could be suspicious. The fact that somebody bled sometime in the last week or so is not that remarkable. And the quote-unquote decomp was just, they were truckers who were on the road and left garbage behind, which was rotting and smelling.
Yeah.
So those kind of circumstantial things, it actually is pretty likely. But when you're hunting for confirmation of your suspicions, it's amazing how many connections you can make, even on something apparently random like this. My only other question is, as you say, was this really just a random tip from an alleged psychic, or did she have reason to point the police towards this house?
Yeah, I mean, not knowing anything about anything.
We don't have the details.
It's hard to say.
Unfolding.
Although
it's still unfolding.
I mean, I'm hoping that maybe somebody is looking into the guy who slit his wrists on the porch. I mean, it was a woman who called in, but there's obviously some bad blood, so to speak, happening around there. So it's not out of the question to imagine that there might be someone who had reason to want to disrupt the people who lived there. You know, that could be a cause.
And the police said that specifically they're looking into the revenge angle, that this was done to make trouble for the homeowners. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to bring in Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, to cover these next few news items because they have an astronomy theme. So, Phil, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me on once again.
It's always great to have you. Phil Platt.
Thanks. Yeah. Rings a bell.
Phil Pratt, what a good guy.
You know, I don't care if people mispronounce my name as long as they know how to spell it and can find it online.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Spoken like a true nerd.
Can we call you Philip?
No.
is your name Philip, or is it really legally just Phil?
I don't know. I'd have to check my birth certificate, which I know actually has my middle name misspelled on it, but there you go.
Phil Plait doesn't know his own name.
Those details are irrelevant.
So, Phil, we were going to talk about this news item about this massive explosion on the sun, and we just had to talk about it with you. So why don't you tell us about it?
This is a pretty good story. The sun goes through these cycles. It has a magnetic field like a magnet. And the magnetic field goes through cycles and it gets stronger every few years. It's an 11-year cycle. So it gets stronger, then it fades, it gets stronger, and it fades. And we're sort of on the ramp up to the peak of solar activity. And we see this manifested on the surface of the sun with sunspots and solar flares and all kinds of cool stuff like that.
Phil, do we know what causes that cycle?
No. That's the good part.
Okay.
Well, there are some models that indicate why the sun's solar cycle goes up and down. It has to do with the way that the gas, it's actually a plasma, it's an ionized gas inside the sun, is circulating around. And it when you move charged particles, you generate a magnetic field. And so this movement is very complicated, and it has to do with the way that this gas is being transported in the solar interior. And what happens is that magnetic field gets dragged along with the stuff inside the sun, breaks through the sun's surface, and that's why we see sunspots and various things. The magnetic field affects the gas itself.
Is it an oscillation, like a Cepheid variable is an oscillation? Is that the theory?
No, it has more to do with the way gas is flowing through the center of the sun. Well, not through the center, but not through the core itself. But the core, the gas is very hot. It radiates that heat away. The gas above that then convects. The hot stuff rises and the cool stuff sinks, just like in the Earth's atmosphere or in a boiling pot of water. And the problem is that's not a simple system. The sun is rotating, so there are rivers of gas, like jet streams, that are moving underneath the sun's surface. It's really complicated, and the models that are trying to figure out how that works, they're not bad. They're doing a decent job, but it's really, really hard to figure out exactly all the motions that are going on inside, this star that we're living nearby.
Right.
So what happens is, as the magnetic field pokes through the surface of the sun, it creates sunspots, and these magnetic lines, you can think of them as like field lines, get tangled up, and there's energy stored in them. And if they get too tangled up, they can actually sort of erupt. One of them snaps, and it sets up a cascade where a lot of them snap, and they all release their energy. You can imagine like a bunch of mousetraps sitting on your floor, and you throw a ping pong ball in there. And as everything bounces around, the mousetraps will release all their energy. You get a lot of snapping and motion and all kinds of craziness. Well, that's what happens. And this can form a solar flare. It's a gigantic explosion on the surface of the sun. And it can be billions of megatons of energy released in just a few minutes. That's what happened on the sun. And it wasn't actually that big of a flare as they go. There are different classes. And this was a, you know, fair to middling sized explosion. But what happened that was pretty unusual is that there was an enormous fountain of gas that erupted off the surface of the sun. And that's not usually associated with these types of events. And now NASA has this Solar Dynamics Observatory, which is this really phenomenal satellite. And it's observing the sun at a lot of different wavelengths. And so we had high resolution, really gorgeous, basically video. It's just images taken every couple of minutes or something like that. And you can string them together to make videos. And so you can see this flare, the eruption, this fountain of material flowing out from the sun and falling back down. And in different wavelengths, it's unbelievable. It looks like, you know, ink flowing through water in one wavelength and another one. It just looks like fiery gas blowing out. It's just spectacular.
So Phil, how long until we all die?
For you? Well, it depends on your lifestyle habits. Is there something you need to tell us?
Well, you know, now I'm just a bit concerned about crazy things flying out of the sun at me.
Well, in this case, this particular event wasn't energetic enough to really do much. It did blow out a cloud of particles called a coronal mass ejection. And that's going to kind of sort of nick the Earth. It's not really directed at us. There may be some aurorae associated with this, probably not much. On the other hand, you know, a big flare, something that's bigger than this, and we saw bigger ones earlier this year in February, they can damage satellites, they can affect the Earth's magnetic field, they can't really cause any specific problems here on Earth directly. You're not going to get irradiated, you're not going to turn into the Incredible Hulk, you're not going to melt, you're not going to turn into Chud or Morlocks or anything like that.
Chud.
Sorry, yeah.
Cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers.
Yeah, I know a couple of you guys probably love to see that happen. But it can
I'm
have
working
effects,
on it.
You know, we have satellites up in space that are can be damaged by this. You're basically zapping them with excess current. And that can fry their electronics. And we depend on a lot of those satellites like GPS, for financial transactions, all kinds of stuff like that. So corporations take this stuff pretty seriously. They try to make sure that their satellites are safeguarded against these kind of events. They, not all of them are. So we have to be careful about this and understand these sorts of events better so that we can build better satellites and protect them. Plus, you know, there are astronauts aboard the International Space Station, and they could be in danger of radioactive, well, not radioactive, it's radiation. It's different than what we might think of as radioactivity, but these are floods of subatomic particles that can come through the metal and whatnot. And I can't believe I just said whatnot, but the metal and other materials, if I want to be a little more scientific, of the space station. And they may have to go to a better protected section of the station so that they don't get irradiated.
Yeah, or otherwise they'll turn into the Fantastic Four, right?
I think that's true, yeah.
Okay.
Although
yeah.
I hope they make a better movie with actual astronauts than they would from the comic book. Those
Phil, awful. If this explosion were aimed right at the Earth, how bad would it have been?
This one wouldn't have been too bad. We'd get some pretty spectacular aurora. You know, you can never say, you know, it's completely safe. We might lose a satellite. Some of them might get damaged. Sometimes satellites like Hubble and a lot of other ones, when they detect that there's excess current or that there's a problem, they shut down automatically. They go into what's called safe mode. Sometimes if we have enough advance warning, if there's a big flare, an X-class flare, one of these gigantic ones like we had earlier this year, or back in 2003 when the sun was just popping them off like popcorn, it was really amazing. If you have enough warning, you can shut down sensitive satellites. And that's something that a lot of people are looking into. There's a space weather center actually here in Boulder. It's not far from where I live. And they monitor the sun very carefully. They issue warnings all the time in the hope that even just a few minutes warning can be enough to shut down these satellites and potentially save, you know, billions or tens of billions of dollars of assets in space.
Hey, Phil, just a few years ago, we were talking about the lack of activity going on in the sun and how that was very unusual, that low amount of activity for a long time. No sunspots for many months in a row. Now that we're seeing since then that the sun is, you know, active again with sunspots and all these other things that the sun does, what can we expect? Does the sun make up for lost time in a sense because of that lower activity? And is it like trying to catch up to an equilibrium now?
Nobody knows. I remember a couple of years ago, people were arguing about this, you know, that this long period of a solar minimum, which we kind of understand why it happened, but, or at least how it happened, but why the circumstances were set up for it to happen are not terribly well understood. But we do know that, it was a record length of time with basically minimal solar activity. And so people were arguing, does this mean that the solar cycle will be also, you know, lower activity when it reaches its peak? Will it be a lower than usual peak? Or will this mean that the sun is building up energy and it's going to explode? But not literally, but, you know, do something really serious. And nobody really knows. And the thing is, you have to be careful. I know you guys talk about anomaly hunting. The sun is going to do stuff like this. In February, we had a bunch of X-class flares. This was a lower energy M-class flare. It was an unusual event because of that fountain of material that had never been seen before. But, you know, who knows if it's actually happened before and we missed it. We just didn't have the equipment to see it. So you can't put too much credit to a single event or even a series of events. We just have to keep, you know, averaging up what's going on and seeing what's going to happen. The peak of this cycle should happen in mid to late 2013 and then into 2014. And it's actually after the peak that we usually see the strongest flares. And we'll just have to see what happens in, you know, mid 2014, 2015, when the sun really starts to, pop these guys off.
It seems a lot like climate science, wherein we can't really, look at it on a day-to-day scale. We have to look at it at this, it's such a complex system. You know, we have to look at it on a much larger scale. But, you know, I think scientists can understand that, but from the perspective of someone who doesn't necessarily know how these things work, I think it's easy for the media to sort of blow things like this out of proportion. Have you seen anything, any terrible reporting on this, in that respect, Phil?
Duh. Actually, this particular event, I poked around a few websites and it was being reported fairly well, but I can't remember which one it was. You know, I want to say it was the Daily Mail, but that's sort of my go-to garbage
guess.
Tabloid, that basically said we're all going to die. I can't remember if that's the one I saw or not. So I don't want to cast aspersions on them when it's not deserved, because usually it is the Daily Mail. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people, you're right. And a lot of the things you said, people don't necessarily understand what's going on. When they see this, they panic. I got some emails from some people who were concerned about this, and I had to say, no, you know, this wasn't that big of a deal. And you're right that, we have to look at the long time scale. Just because a bunch of tornadoes broke out across the Midwest or in New England over the past few weeks doesn't mean the earth is warming. Even if we get stronger hurricanes or more hurricanes this season or a longer hurricane season, doesn't mean, you know, that global warming is affecting it. You can't look at it that way. You've just got to take a step back, use longer timescale bins, and hope that these trends are enough that you can actually see what's going on.
Right. Yeah, and how many 11-year cycles have we been able to observe? How long have we had good observation of the sun?
Well, the first observations of the solar magnetic activity were actually in 1859. And it's pretty interesting. The guy, Carrington, looked at the sun with a visible light telescope and saw a flare, which is extremely rare for a flare to be bright enough to actually be seen in visible light. It's still, to this day, the strongest solar flare that's ever been seen. It caused all kinds of havoc on the earth at the time with telegraph lines and stuff. And so we've been, you know, measuring the sun's activity now for about 150 years. And, when you look at the cycles, they're all over the place. Some are really strong. Some last longer. Some are shorter. Some are weaker. It's difficult to know what any given cycle is going to do. We can only say that it's roughly 11 years. It's not exactly 11 years. The activity tends to be strongest after the peak, that sort of stuff. But for any given event, you can't really predict it. You can see, hey, look, there's a big old sunspot cluster there, and the magnetic fields in them are really strong. We ought to be keeping our eyes on it. But that's no different than, you know, a tropical depression appearing in the Atlantic and the conditions look good for it to form a hurricane. You never know what's going to happen. You just have to keep your eyes open for the precursors and hope for the best.
Well, Phil, there's a couple other news items we'd like you to hang around for, if that's okay. Bob, give us a summary on the new computer models about the formation of the moon.
Define summary. Okay.
It's the opposite of wintry. Yeah. Nice.
All right.
Not research. Bob length.
Researchers are redefining the rarity of Earth, the Earth-Moon system. They're saying that a whopping 1 in 10 rocky planets may have a satellite that's as big as our moon when compared to the Earth. Using these new sophisticated computer simulations, it seems that the massive impacts that resulted in our relatively huge moon may be common, actually, throughout the universe. Now, this research is coming from scientists from the Zurich Institute of Theoretical Physics in Switzerland and Ryuja Morishima at the University of Colorado in the U.S. They simulated planet formation from gas and chunks of planetesimals. And then they took these results and they factored them into another simulation, an N-body simulation, to see what the chances were of that large satellites could form from that. So they were quite surprised to find that there was about a 1 in 12 chance of forming a planet and a satellite moon with both having more than half the mass of the Earth and the moon respectively. Now, I liked how the BBC news article I read kind of went into a little bit more statistical information about this. They were saying that the 1 in 12 or 1 in 10 figure that you read everywhere else, they were saying that for the full range of probabilities, it was between 1 in 45 and 1 in 4. So that's kind of what the statistics were telling them. And they kind of distilled that down to, well, it's about 1 in 12. So now this is all tied, of course, to the once controversial and now pretty much generally accepted theory about how our moon formed. The common wisdom now is that it was a collision between the Earth Mark One, which the kind of some people refer to it as Earth Mark One, colliding with this Mars-sized object and creating a huge debris ring, which kind of coalesced in about 100 years to form the moon as we know it. Of course, it was a lot closer. It's about 15 times larger. The apparent size is about 15 times larger than the way we see it now. The cool thing here is that this could actually help with planet hunting. I wasn't aware of this. Large moons can distort the measurements that made to find planets. So this new knowledge could actually make finding them easier. Now, Phil, I wasn't sure. I mean, just because you know this fact, how could it actually make it easier? I mean, what is it about the distortion? How could a moon distort the measurements finding a planet? I mean, it's a planet and a moon are pretty much like one system from a distance anyway. I was having a hard time trying to figure out how a big moon could distort planet hunter measurements. But
actually, I'm with you. I don't know. I read the press release, and it's pretty vague on that. I have not read the actual paper or talked to anybody about this. The way you find planets, there are actually a bunch of ways. But the two big ones are either the way the planet is pulling on the star, and as it orbits the star is making a little circle, and it creates a Doppler shift, and you can see that sort of red and blue shift in the star spectrum. But that should not be affected very much by a big moon. It's hard enough to see that with a low mass planet like the Earth around a star. It's a very, very tiny effect. The bigger the planet and the closer in it is, the more that effect is and the easier it is to see. And it's hard for me to see how a moon would affect that. I don't know. I'm not that familiar with it.
Okay.
The other way is through transits where the planet literally gets between us and its star and it blocks a little bit of the starlight. Now for a Jupiter-sized planet, in a star like the sun, it'll block about 1% of the star's light, which is actually fairly easy to measure. You can do it using equipment you can buy off the shelf, which is really cool. For an Earth-like planet, the effect is actually, I think, a 10,000th of the brightness of the star, which is a lot harder to measure. If there's a moon that's orbiting that planet and the moon is like our moon, a significant fraction of the planet's size, then you might see more or less light dropping. If the planet and the moon transit the star, you get a slightly bigger dip than if the moon is, say, lined up with the planet in from our point of view, if that makes any sense. It's hard to show this in a diagram. That's the only way I can see it off the top of my head. There may be other things. You'd need to talk to an exoplanet hunter to get the details on this.
Exoplanet hunter. That's what a cool job.
That is a great name.
The other thing that this highlights is just the importance of the moon itself. The moon, without the moon, the Earth would be a very different place. And I think it's a pretty safe bet that Homo sapiens would not be here without the moon. One of the big things that it does, it stabilizes the tilt of the Earth's axis, or it's referred to as its obliquity. Without this, the tilt would vary greatly over extended time spans, which would really kind of mess with the overall heating of the Earth in ways that could make it fairly inimical to life, although I'm sure it would find ways around it.
Would that be needed, though, if nothing had smashed into the Earth in the first place to create the moon? In other words, is the moon just balancing out the wobble that was created by its own creation?
No. Nope. Without the moon and without any impact, they think, and I think they've found some good examples that, the tilt would vary over a lot over great periods of time, which would.
Because there are a lot of planets without moons. What is it about the Earth that makes it require a moon?
Well, think of it this way. If you have a spinning top and it's perfectly balanced, it'll spin really well. But if you put a lump of clay on one side of it and let it spin, it'll start to wobble, and that wobble can become chaotic. And so that's kind of what's happening with the Earth. You've got continents which are moving around and they cause it to be off balance. As the Earth spins and as the moon pulls on the Earth, you get a bulge around the middle of the Earth. And it's the torque of the moon on that bulge, I think, that stabilizes it. I'm not an expert in this, but that's how I understand it. And so that prevents the Earth's wobble from becoming chaotic. Venus spins much more slowly than the Earth, so I don't think it's as big of a deal. Mars, on the other hand, has roughly the same rate of spin as the Earth. It spins once a day. And there is evidence that in the past, the axis of its spin has changed, and sometimes a lot, indicating that, and I should add that it does not have a big moon. It has two little dinky moons. And so it's possible that without that big moon, torquing the Earth and keeping the spin from going all wonky, you get a planet that flips over, and that has drastic effects on the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's not obvious, and it's certainly not easy to understand how that all works, but it does seem to be the way the science is pointing right now.
Yeah, I remember when I was reading about the stabilizing effect of the moon on the Earth and, you know, how nice it is, you know, to have that, and at the same time, how rare the previous thinking was about, you know, how common we would see an Earth-Moon type of system. I was depressed. I said, well, that means there's probably going to be very, very few worlds out there that are as compatible with, you know, human life as our own system. So if this is true, if these computer models are correct, and it's actually far more common, maybe on average one per solar system or something on that order of magnitude, that's reassuring for prospects of habitable planets out there.
Absolutely.
You know, it's reassuring, but it does not surprise me at all. I have never bought into the rare Earth idea. You can say Earths must be common because we're on one. What are the odds? But that's, you know, you guys know all about that. It's like the water in the puddle saying, you know, how remarkable it is that there's just enough water in here to fit the puddle. You're looking at it the wrong way. So the idea that we're just the right size, just the right distance from the sun, with a moon and a magnetic field, and. It's like, you know, I'm not buying into all this. I think that there are lots of Earths out there. It's not uncommon to see stars like the sun. 10% of the stars in the galaxy are like the sun. We're starting to see that planets are common. We're starting to get an idea that possibly planets the size of the Earth are common. If they're spinning rapidly and they have enough radioactive materials in their core, they're going to have a magnetic field. And so I think that that's something we're going to see as common. And now, you know, if the moon is important for us to be here, it seems very unlikely that we'd be the only planet in the galaxy like that. And we know that collisions are common. We know that the planets are moving around in their star systems early on in the history of these things. And so all of this stuff does not strike me as being all that surprising. I would have expected it. I don't know if I would have said as many as 1 in 4 Earth-like planets might have big moons, but the way objects get tossed around and the recent finding that there may be more planets wandering interstellar space than there are stars in the galaxy.
Mm. Yeah, how cool is that?
That lends credence to this. The planets are moving around, they interact with each other, they change positions in the solar system, they toss each other out gravitationally, so we know that this stuff happens. So I wouldn't use the word inevitable, but I would say that this finding is not surprising. It's just cool.
Yeah, it's never been aesthetically pleasing to me to think that the Earth is really, really rare for all the reasons that you said. There's sort of the principle of mediocrity or whatever you call it, that chances are we're an unremarkable planet around an unremarkable star and an unremarkable galaxy. You know, there's no reason to think that we have a very special position in the universe. But there is a bit of the lottery fallacy, as you were alluding to. If life were very rare, any life that did arise would marvel at how rare it was, right?
Unless there were two planets in that system that had life on them.
Yeah, right.
Right.
But see, the premise is if life were rare. So that would be possible, but exceedingly unlikely. But the billions of planets roaming around interstellar space is fascinating, but it's also a bit scary because you think, well, what's the possibility that like a Jupiter-sized planet can come ripping through the solar system, you know?
Very, very rare.
Space is a big place.
Yeah, I mean, the odds of that happening are extremely low. If they were high, we probably wouldn't be here, right? If over the course of 4.5 billion years, the age of the Earth, some Jupiter-sized planet, if the odds were 100% that it would scream through the inner solar system, it would have happened by now. And so obviously the odds are very, very low. So I'm not too concerned about it. It makes for a great science fiction movie or a good novel or something like that. But I wouldn't necessarily bet on it as a certainty. Certainly they're out there. That's something I've been wondering about for a long time, is if there are frozen planets out there. And it was nice to see this big study. I mean, this is not theoretical. These were observations that these planets gave themselves away through their gravity, affecting stars behind them and magnifying that light using basically a relativistic lens. It's a gravitational lens that Einstein predicted. So this is a direct observation, and extrapolating to the entire sky, you get, you know, this number of hundreds of billions of planets like this, which is awesome. But I don't think that, you know, hundreds of billions of planets spread out over the volume of a galaxy is still pretty thin stuff. So I don't think this is that big of a problem for us.
And what are the chances of any of those planets having life? I mean, you got to consider them small to none.
Hard to say. You know, Jupiter is warmer than it would be. Let me rephrase that. It's actually radiating more heat than it receives from the sun, leftover heat from its formation, as well as some other sources of heat. So a giant planet could still be fairly warm. But there are other problems. There are gigantic convection currents that bring gas up and down. So any life that's forming in there in a temperate zone would probably be dragged down to the hotter interior. So that's always been a problem with theoretical models for how life might be inside of a Jupiter-like planet. But you know what? I've learned not to bet against nature. And I think that's the way to go. If they're out there, who knows? We'd have to go and take a look to be sure.
Phil, this is all good, but what's with the attitude?
Shut up. What attitude?
You tell him.
It was my attitude.
My attitude of optimism and joy at the wonders of the universe? Is that what you're complaining about?
I'm pretty sure I've asked you this before, but I live like a moment-by-moment life, which means that, you know, you could tell me the same
joke.
Don't we all? But, Phil, do you ever, because you really understand things and you know what's out there and you can write books like the one you did about all the 59 which ways that we can get killed, do you ever legitimately get frightened?
Like of clowns, things like that.
Like crying in your bed at
night. No, I mean,
would I admit?
Is there anything that occurs where you're like, you know what, that is downright frightening? If that, you know, like, I don't like the idea that that might be coming at us a million miles an hour right now. You know what I mean?
Oh, there's a ton of stuff like that. But you got to differentiate between that stuff existing and that stuff being an actual danger, a threat to the Earth. Gamma ray bursts, supernovae, and my favorite, magnetars, which are these incredibly magnetically charged neutron stars that just have field strength that is quadrillions of times the Earth's magnetic field. And they can let go of these super enormous blasts of energy. And we got hit by one back in 2004, actually, although it didn't really damage us. If there were one closer to us, it could. But you know what? We haven't been damaged by one of those things. There has not been a gamma ray burst in human history that's hurt us. There are no stars close enough to go supernova that can hurt us in that way. So these aren't the kind of things I worry about. You know, an asteroid impact, yeah, that could happen. A solar flare damaging our satellites and causing issues down here because of that. That's a legitimate worry. But those are also things we can choose to protect ourselves from. We just haven't made that choice yet. So I don't lie awake at night fretting about these kind of things. I have to worry about paying my taxes and what my kid is doing. Those are more of the day-to-day things I'm terrified about.
Yeah, Jay, it's far worse being a physician, because like, I know all the ways in which your body can fail, and one of them will happen to you soon.
Soon? Oh, you know, my God.
Yeah, like a threat.
Soon-ish.
You know, within decades, which on you know, astronomical scales is much quicker than anything that Phil has to worry about.
So, okay, Steve, do you lie in bed at night and go, no!
There definitely are times where I get little symptoms and I know all the horrible things it could be a symptom of, and I just have to say, all right, don't worry about it. It's probably nothing, and so far it has been.
You know, what I find, as I get older, I ask myself a lot, and I mean this dead serious, I ask myself, am I having a heart attack right now? Is that a heart attack? Is that it? Is that pain right there? Is that the beginning of like the end? Yeah.
No, it's true. Like when you're in your 20s and you get a little like left-sided chest pain, you don't worry about it. You're like, I'm 25. You know, I'm not having a heart attack. But when you're 46 and the same exact thing happens, you're like, okay, how much do I got to worry about this?
Hey, wait a minute. Why'd you choose the age of 46?
Because that's my current age, and we're the same age.
Really? So. Okay. Yeah, that's my age as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is, yeah, we're getting to that age where, you know, little things like that crop up and it's actually statistically plausible that it could be something serious. Yeah,
everything is cancer. You know, every time I look and I see a new mole on my shoulder or something, it's like, oh no.
I don't even do that with moles. With me, it's just whatever random pain I have. Well, it's cancer of the whatever that is.
Whatever that is. You have
of the connecticutzoid.
McLavin.
McLavin. All right, one more news item. Just with it, we have to end on a funny one, Phil.
Yeah.
Evan, tell us about UFO Nazis.
Well, how about this one? So there is an author, and her name is Annie Jacobson, and she has a new book that is out called Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. She spends the majority of her time in this book talking about the legitimate science and projects and experimental aircraft and other things that have been taking place at this facility for the past 60 years. She got together with some of the people who used to work there who had declassified information, and they were able to share it. However, it's the last chapter of her book that's making headlines because she is drawing the conclusion that the famous saucer crash involved with Area 51 in Roswell that took place is actually a conspiracy in which the Auschwitz butcher Dr. Joseph Mengele, the German aircraft designing brothers, the Horten brothers, and Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin formed a conspiracy in the late 1940s to scare America silly with a Nazi Soviet flying saucer which was crowded, get this, with 13-year-olds, which were surgically altered under the...
By Joseph Mengele.
By Joseph Mengele.
Yeah, to look alien. And
to look alien, and that is actually the recovered pieces of the famous crash. And those people, those surgically altered people, are the supposed aliens that were recovered from the crash.
Well, I'll never again say that the 9/11 truthers have the dumbest conspiracy theory out there.
Well, you know there's always got to be one dumber than whatever you're currently talking about.
That's true.
Now, Annie Jacobson is a journalist. And from the reviews I've read about the book is that she does a, you know, decent, not perfect job in the various chapters of the book that have to deal with the hard sciences. But this last chapter in which she draws this conclusion, she's basing it entirely upon an unnamed source, one person, an unnamed source.
Glenn Beck. Who, sorry. Something in my throat there.
Might as well be. Who apparently fed her all this information, and that's what she's going by. And she says,
right.
I totally trust this source. I mean, he's very, very reliable.
I think I know who the source is. The source is her publicist.
I was going to say that. No, right, Rebecca.
Exactly.
No one would be talking about this if it weren't for that last chapter.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you have to have a new angle to this whole story if you want your book to sell well in these days.
Yeah, especially because it was the last chapter. It's like, you know, she turned in the completed book and it was all sourced and nice and ready to go. And they're like, this is good, but...
It's way too accurate.
Can't we just throw in...
Yeah,
just one giant lie at the end. Just tack it on.
Yeah.
Good job.
It's like Steve Martin tells that joke. If you're making demands, you have to always throw in that one crazy one. I want the letter M stricken from the alphabet. That way you can always claim insanity afterwards. It's sort of a similar thing. In the last chapter, you got to go totally off the rails and start making crazy conspiracy theories because that's what's going to sell your book.
Well, I actually have two comments on this. One, is that this idea that Nazis are tied with UFOs has been around for a long time. I remember reading a novel based on this conspiracy theory back when I was in grad school in the 90s. And the book wasn't new then. I think it was called Genesis. It was this ginormous, you know, 800-page science fiction novel. It sounded fun. And it was just the Nazis, basically the Nazi scientists that were behind all this escaped. They moved to Antarctica. They built a base there. They perfected UFO technology and we're going to rise again, basically. So this has been around a while.
This is Richard Hoagland. He wrote Our Breakaway Nazi Civilization. He thinks NASA's run by Nazis. And they're the shadow government that's doing all this UFO face on Mars stuff.
You know, as soon as you say Richard Hoagland, you just put a period after that and we're done.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Just out.
Hoagland!
Oh, yeah.
Steve, when you say that, you know, just quickly going through your mind, like, okay, he really believes that there's Nazis out there. And I have to make light of this real quick. But does he actually think they're still wearing their badass clothes with the leather and the boots and, you know, they still have Lugers and...
There are still Nazis out there. Let's not suggest that there's no such thing as Nazis anymore.
Jay, I'm looking at a picture on his website, and it's a spaceship, a Nazi spaceship that looks like a modified, like, Nazi helmet with a skull and crossbones on the front.
Right. All right, there's my answer.
Well, there would not be difficult, mein Führer.
There's a movie coming out about a Nazi spaceship. Nazi UFOs from the moon. It actually looks like a pretty fun movie.
Okay. Is it a porn? What?
Nazi UFOs from the moon?
Does anybody know what the... it was announced about a year ago. I think it's an independent project, and they've... You know, this is a great idea for a fictionalized novel or movie. You know, but on the other hand, you know, most of the stuff that Hoagland does is heavily fictionalized. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Phil, also there have been, stories in the past, drawn up by the UFO crowd that, the Soviets had something to do with, the crash at Roswell the famous crash that took place at Roswell as well. So what's happening is kind of blending all of these different aspects together, you know, and the alien bodies that were supposedly recovered. Right, so you're taking, she's kind of picking out these pieces and forming her own little opinion as to what this all means to her.
Well, you know, it was the expanding time waves from the Roswell crash that caused Building 7 to collapse on September 11th. So.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually.
Oh. I hate when time waves do that.
Really? I've got the equations right here. It's quite simple, actually, to even the most dimmest person. to do a second Simpsons
most
quote.
Most dimmest.
But, you know, I want to say one other thing about this, too. In the article on weirdnews.aol.com where Ms. Jacobson is being quoted, she says, you know, I don't have to – well, what happened was these guys basically came out and said, listen, we were sources for some of her information in the book, the good stuff in the book, and we were shocked by this last chapter. And I can't believe she took our information and did this, and she didn't ask us about this. And she's quoted here as saying – this is a quote. For starters, journalists don't share their information with their sources prior to publication. That's a standard rule, she said. So I'm following journalistic tradition. So really what she's saying is, you know, I got this information. I'm not going to go check with the experts on it to find out what's going on because journalists don't do that. Okay. So you know what? I think they do. I think that's exactly what you're
saying. That's BS.
They check their sources. So that quotation by her really sets off a lot of alarms in my head. And she goes on to say, what others think of my book can't matter to me in terms of being a journalist. You know, the word journalist is not a shield to be able to say whatever you want. And
yeah, maybe she calls herself a journalist enough times, she'll actually become a journalist. That must be what she's thinking.
You know... I've seen stuff like this happen before, and I always want to give the writer the benefit of a doubt. You know, I don't know what's going on. I haven't read the book. I only read this article. The article could be sensationalizing the last chapter. It could be relatively harmless and being misinterpreted, whatever. But these quotations from her really make me suspicious about the integrity of that last chapter. I think I'm safe in saying that.
Well, Phil, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for having me on. It's always fun.
And we're going to see you at TAM in about, 4 weeks?
I'll see you guys at TAM. I'm going to see you at PsyCon in New Orleans in October.
And Dragon Con.
Yeah, I can't wait for Dragon Con. That's going to be great.
You're going to be sick of us.
Yeah.
Going to be.
I'm sorry, going to be?
I'm
sick of all of
you.
Hello.
More so.
All right, good night, Phil.
Thanks, later, folks. Talk to you later.
Bye, buddy.
Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
It is, Steve. I'm going to play for you last week's Who's That Noisy? Here it comes.
What's so funny, guys?
Oh, nothing.
Because it implies things, Steve. We have, you know, vivid imaginations.
Yeah. So, Evan, what is that?
Well, that is...
It's a cryo pump.
It is a cryo pump, in fact. More specifically, it's a helium pump on what I'm told is a newly designed MRI machine. The helium is used to keep the magnets cool.
It's a super cooled MRI scanner.
The person who sent in that noisy to us, his name is Matt. Thank you, Matt. And he's an acoustician. And he was called in to consult on stopping the noise from being heard on the floor above because the sound of this helium pump measures at about 66 decibels.
Yeah, because MRI scans weren't noisy enough to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Person to correctly guess first, his name is James Wickens, a listener. And I just want to read you this email quick because I think it's cool. He said, I'd like to guess this week's Who's That Noisy? I think it's a cryo pump. Not sure if it's the compressor or the expansion head. The noise becomes maddening very quickly. He's spent 10 years of his 4 years of his 4 year PhD sitting next to one of these machines.
10 years of his 4 year wow. PhD.
That's what he wrote. He said it felt like 10 years.
Oh, I see.
But apparently he was around this machine quite a bit and is very familiar with the noise that this thing generates. I thought that was very cool.
But at the end of it all, he got to get Who's That Noisy correct 1 week.
So it was all worth it.
It was
his first time. Congratulations, James. Very well done.
Yes. As we said, no matter what we come up with, somebody's done their thesis on it or is a world expert in it. This guy sat next to this cryo pump for 4 years.
Right.
But he feels really good about himself right now.
Shows up on a broadcast or podcast that he listens to, and he's like, oh, I know that.
I have
consensus excitement.
What do you got for this week, Evan?
Okay, here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
It's just not so. Allah is actually an ancient Judaic mysticism, and I know you're here to.
So there it is. Please post your message on our forum or send us an email at info@theskepticsguide.org. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. Let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you are all welcome to play along at home if you so choose. And if you don't...
It's not like we can stop them.
You could just listen. That's true. You're not free to play along, so stop it. Okay. Are you guys ready?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Here we go. Item number one, astronomers find evidence that some or perhaps all of the large moons of Jupiter were protoplanets captured from the inner solar system in the early days of the solar system when Jupiter was much closer to the sun. Item number two, research finds that citizens from so-called blue states are just as likely to hold liberal or conservative views on specific issues as citizens from red states. This refers to the United States, of course. And item number three, scientists discover that dolphins actually project two beams of ultrasound for use in echolocation. Rebecca, since you're the farthest away, or is it furthest?
Farthest.
You get to go furthest.
First. Furthest. You get furthest. To go first.
Okay. I'm trying to think way back to that interview we had with the bad astronomer when we were talking about moons. Yeah, why not? Jupiter is very large, and its gravitational pull, could grab some fairly large hunks of rock and get them into its orbit. Blue states, people in blue states are just as likely to hold liberal or conservative views as those in red states. This I can understand too, because when we talk about blue versus red states, we talk about, we're actually talking about who those states are electing or attempting to vote for in terms of political party, but that doesn't necessarily break down by views. Which leaves us with dolphins projecting two beams of ultrasound. That's awesome. Two beams of ultrasound for use in echolocation. That would be really super handy because you would, I guess it would be sort of like the difference between having one eye and having two eyes. You'd have stereo vision. Why not? I think that that can exist. So I don't really know, Steve. Therefore, I am going to go with, I'm going to say that the Jupiter item is in fact false. Because if Jupiter was much closer to the sun, it would be more difficult for it to gravitationally attract protoplanets away from the sun's orbit. So that's why, I guess.
Okay. All right, Jay?
Yeah, I would have actually thought that the first one about Jupiter was science if you didn't say that it was when it was closer to the sun. The idea that Jupiter started off closer to the sun doesn't make sense to me. So I'm going to agree with Rebecca. I don't think that that one is science because there's something about that one that sounds really fishy to me.
Don't you think the dolphin one sounds fishy?
Sounds bad.
I'm tired.
Okay, Evan?
Protoplanets captured from the inner solar system. Well, the moons of Jupiter, several of them do have planet-like features, atmospheres, and volcanic activity. And so, moving on to the second one. With these blue states versus red states, are just as likely to hold liberal or conservative views on specific issues. That's the key, I believe. Specific issues, yes. Now, dolphins projecting two beams of ultrasound, that is interesting. It could be like you said, Rebecca, stereo vision. This is stereo ultrasound. But how exactly do scientists know that? I think the dolphins one is going to turn out to be science, and that just leaves Jupiter. The Jupiter one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I may have to jump on this bandwagon, although their reasoning was fairly flawed.
GWR,
Bob, just say you agree with it and shut up, okay?
Having read all items, go ahead, Bob.
No, the ultrasound one in dolphins, yeah, I mean, I don't have an issue with how it was detected. I'm not sure how the dolphin could pull it off, but detecting it I don't think would be that terrible of a problem. But it doesn't surprise me that they were able to create two beams of sound. The second one with the blue states and the red states, I think Rebecca handled that one pretty well. Yeah, it's specific issues as well were kind of a key phrase there. I don't have a problem with that one. The first one though, just with Jupiter, just seems way, way wrong to me. The odd thing about this is that, okay, you've got Jupiter capturing inner planets. That's interesting. But then at the very end, you're like, when Jupiter was closer to the sun. Well, wait a second. What? I mean, obviously, he's referring to those so-called hot Jupiters, the big gas giants that we found plenty of them near, very, very close to their parent star, which is really odd. But you're just throwing that in at the end as like an add-on. Like, well, wait a second. To me, that's even more interesting that they figured out that Jupiter was indeed closer to the sun. I don't care about the planets. So tell me about that. So that just makes this really out of whack for me.
You see?
I love and you,
so, all right. I'll just stop and say that I think Jupiter is fiction.
All right. So you guys all
Jupiter's
agree.
Jupiter's definitely there, though.
You guys all agree that number one is the fiction. So let's take this in reverse order.
Ooh,
we'll start with scientists discover that dolphins actually project two beams of ultrasound for use in echolocation. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is science.
Science.
That was the scientist that discovered this, Dr. Evil, who was looking for sharks with laser beams and he wound up with dolphins with ultrasound.
No. Beams. But there were engineers involved. So you might wonder, we've been studying dolphin echolocation for, what, 40, 50 years. How did they miss it?
I
was hoping somebody would think about that because that would have maybe made you think of it as being fiction. But they missed it because, you know, partly we didn't have the equipment to really separate out the two beams. They are of different frequencies, so you got to sort of tease apart these mixed, you know, beams of ultrasound into the different frequencies. And the second thing is that dolphins have been studied mainly by biologists. They didn't necessarily have the engineering chops to do this. But now there's a collaboration between biologists and engineers, and they were able to use more sophisticated equipment to study their echolocation. And lo and behold, there's two beams.
Awesome.
They still don't know how they produce it. They do have two organs for producing sound. So the obvious conclusion.
Maybe that's how they did it.
Yeah, each one's producing.
It one's does, playing this organ and the other's playing that organ.
Oh, man.
Does seem pretty obvious.
I thought there was one.
That, okay, each one is
Aaron
producing.
Aaron Podcaster one. Solves decades-old mystery.
But that's not necessarily the answer. It could be, you know, that. Because they've previously thought that only one was really producing the sound at a time, and it could still be the way the ultrasound is echoing inside the chambers in the head and the skull producing the two waves. They don't know yet. So the simplest solution may not, in fact, be the answer. But, yeah. But, you know, yeah, there's two organs there, so maybe it's just one is making each beam. And sure, it would you could see obviously how it would give them more precision in using their echolocation if you have two beams to bounce off of stuff. All right, I better move on to number two. Research finds that citizens from so-called blue states are just as likely to hold liberal or conservative views on specific issues as citizens from red states. So really, you guys think there's no difference in people from blue to red states? In terms of their conservative to liberal
specific
views?
Specific issues.
There can be a difference between people. I'm just saying specific issues. And one thing I didn't mention, which I shouldn't mention now because it might be totally wrong, but there's also the fact that, you know, our weird way of electing people in means we give more weight to different states. So, you know, the distribution of population is different from what you would expect when you just look at a map and you see like a red state. That's all.
Right. Well, this one is science.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I was a little surprised, but as I was trying to wrap my head around the statistics of this, if a very red state tends to vote conservative, then why wouldn't more of those people have conservative views than people in a state that's very blue and tends to vote liberal? But so the researchers made a few points. One is that the conservative-liberal divide is not necessarily the same as the Republican-Democrat divide, and the red-blue is really based upon party affiliation.
That's what I was trying to say,
yeah.
But
okay.
Didn't quite get out.
So that's one factor, and that's interesting because you think that, you know, liberal conservative, you know, thinking may be fairly genetic or may be the kind of thing that depends on, you know, how you're raised, but the culture may have more of a dramatic effect on party affiliation because we're very tribal. So people with liberal views may still decide that they are Republican and vote Republican or vice versa. But then when you really push them and just you take it out of the context of party affiliation and just say, all right, what do you feel about this issue? Then they're not necessarily engaging their tribal Democratic or Republican, you know, views anymore. They're just thinking about that issue and they're actually more evenly divided. And not only that, but on a lot of issues, there's huge overlap. So in some issues there were, you know, that are traditionally thought of as conservative or liberal, there's like between 60 and 77% of people believe the same thing of sort of overlap in their opinion. So there's people agree a lot more than you might think, especially given how politically polarized our country has been recently. They also make the point, Rebecca, which I think you were trying to make, that
it's hard to tell what I'm trying to say.
It is, but you were creeping up on it, that the primary election process does tend to emphasize extremes, right? Just the election process itself. Yeah, so that tends to make states look more polarized or extreme than maybe they really are based upon just the people living there.
Yeah, that was a smarter way to say.
Yeah, so like for example, a red state may have a more mobilized Republican base, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the average citizen is more conservative. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All of this means that astronomers find evidence that some or perhaps all of the large moons of Jupiter were protoplanets captured from the inner solar system in the early days of the solar system when Jupiter was much closer to the sun is fiction.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
We win.
Which part is fiction?
Now, did any of you read the news story on which this is based?
No.
No.
I did not.
Okay, that's the problem. This would have been much more plausible had you had some contact with the news item on which it was based. And I was...
Yay, ignorance.
I was going back and forth, yeah, like, laziness. Which one should I twist to the fiction? I almost made the dolphin one, but then I just decided to do this one. This would have been a pretty good real one if I didn't twist it into the fiction. So,
what's the real one?
The real one is that astronomers have used a computer simulation. That would have been the weak part. You know, like, simulation. You could believe anything in a simulation. But they are. This is the same kind of stuff they were doing with the moon, Bob, where they were using these same computer simulations of early solar system formation,
yeah,
to run models of like what happens typically in a solar system when it's forming. And you brought up the hot Jupiters.
Yeah.
It's interesting that a lot of solar systems that we're looking at have Jovian or Jupiter-sized planets that are very close to their sun. Do you know why that happens?
I thought we weren't sure. Last I heard, we weren't quite sure why, how the hell that happens.
So according to this computer simulation, that happens because these Jovian planets form when there's still a certain amount of gas in the early solar system.
Oh, the gravity coalesces. Oh, the drag.
It's the drag of
the slow the orbit. You get closer, yeah.
Yeah, so the orbit slowly spirals in. And then when all the gas goes away, the planet basically is where it is. Except there was an interaction between Saturn and Jupiter in this simulation that caused both of them to move out to their current positions. So it's interesting, you know, that the Jupiter did move in. It got as close as the orbit of Mars to the sun.
Wow. Wonder what that would look like in the sky if Jupiter were in the orbit of Mars.
Naked eye? Cool. Probably not that different.
Not much, yeah. Bright star.
Yeah, but and they say that the influence of Jupiter kept Mars from getting bigger than it is today. Mars would have been a bigger planet had this not happened. And also, in this simulation, Jupiter is what kept the asteroid belt from coalescing into a planet and keeping it spread out. The gravitational influence of Jupiter kept it spread out as an asteroid belt rather than...
I feel like I've heard that before, though. Is that not a... that's like not a new...
Well, this is a computer... Yeah, I think this has been speculation, but this is a computer simulation that shows it. So Jupiter moved closer to the sun, got as close as about the orbit of Mars, and then moved out to its current position and then settled into place there. So that was the bit that made the whole, you know, coming closer to the sun plausible. Capturing the moon and evidence rather than a simulation are the bits that I add. The Galilean satellites or the large Jovian moons wouldn't really be good candidates for capture because they orbit in the plane of Jupiter's rotation. So they probably formed in situ, yeah, in place and probably were not captured.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah. But good work, everyone. Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have a quote. This is a quote from Eric Butterworth. Seeing is not believing. Believing is seeing. You see things not as they are, but as you are. Eric Butterworth!
He also makes one hell of a syrup, I understand.
Oh, my God.
His wife does.
His wife, yeah.
His wife.
That's sexist, Evan.
I bet he never heard that in grade school.
Yeah. Well, how long ago did this guy live? The Eric Butterworth Foundation? You can change your life by altering your thoughts. I hope it's not this guy.
Oh, my God. I bet that is that guy. This quote makes sense now in a completely different context.
Your desire is proof positive of your ability. Holy Jesus.
Wow. All right. So I found this quote online. And then, I look up Eric Butterworth, want to know who the guy is. And I actually could not correlate the quote to the specific Eric Butterworth. But he's the only Eric Butterworth I found online. He was a minister. And he belongs to the Unity School of Christianity.
This is really funny because the phrase seeing is not believing, believing is seeing is something we say to summarize the power of expectation and belief on perception.
Yeah.
Right. It's a skeptical lesson.
But he seems to be implying that the secret sort of
thing, but
where
he's saying,
if you believe hard enough, you'll see it.
Because you'll change your actual reality. That's ironic. Okay.
Eric Butterworth, confused.
Unintentional skeptic.
Unintentional skeptic.
The accidental skeptic.
The accidental skeptic. It happens.
Good night, everyone.
Night all.
And he's taking night all?
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
I'm Eric Butterworth, say.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.